Hello and welcome to Nexium on Trial, a resumption of the podcast from the Albany Times-Union, looking at the legal travails of Nexium, the shadowy organization based here in the Capital Region, and its leader, Keith Raniere, who remains in federal custody awaiting sentencing after his conviction 2 months ago, a little bit more than 2 months ago, which was the last time that we recorded one of these podcasts. I'm Casey Seiler, the managing editor of the Times-Union. I am joined by Rob Gavin, our Cops and Courts reporter, and Brendan Lyons, our investigations editor and Capitol Bureau chief. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining me. So we've got a lot of kind of catch up, and we are marking this occasion because this week we're talking on August 28th is a couple of days after what would have been the start of Vanguard Week, which back in the days when Nexium was riding high, was the annual week-long celebration of Keith Raniere's birthday, which fell this week on Monday when he turned 59 years old in the federal lockup in Brooklyn. So I guess to lead off, the news of the day, which did in fact come out on Monday, was news that Nexium is now on the hook for more than $1.3 million, which it will have to pay to Interfor, an investigations firm that did work for Nexium, in its pursuit of cult expert Rick Ross.
I think that this was sort of a victory against Nexium in favor of an entity that, at least according to Ross, had and evidence, had done its bidding. They were part and parcel to their efforts to dig up dirt on Rick Ross, and when we spoke to him this week, he felt there could not be a lesser deserving party to get this money than Interfor. But Nexium made an agreement with Interfor when they hired him. Interfor makes everyone they do business with sign an agreement so that basically if you get sued, if there's any kind of legal trouble, it's on you, not us.
If we get sued for doing what you want us to do and we have properly informed
Correct.
You of what we are going to do, you are going to keep us whole.
Correct,
we are not, we won't be held liable for anything that we do on your behalf.
And what happened was sort of halfway through the middle of this, there were, you know, there's lawsuits. And they get sued by Rick Ross, who files a countersuit against them. There's this huge lawsuit going on for years. And they end up actually paying about $165,000 worth of legal bills on behalf of Interfor. And then they change law firms and they're like, oh, well, you know what? You went too far. We're not going to pay this anymore. And what's kind of amazing is for the first 8 or 9 years, they were claiming that, oh, well, you know, we weren't supportive of you going after Rick Ross.
Nexium saying this
exactly.
About Interfor's behavior.
And then did a total about face.
To set the table for people who may not know, Rick Ross is a cult expert and had long been a critic of Nexium and highlighted that they had cult-like activities and at one point published some of their materials on his website. That triggered a federal lawsuit against Rick Ross by Nexium, that where this came into play. That's where the legal war started, and he was dragged through a decade of litigation. And lucky for him, he had pro bono counsel, because I think it would have been a struggle for him to go up against Nexium in a federal lawsuit that went that long.
Rick Ross ended up testifying at Keith Raniere's trial, describing his long history, Nexium's long litigation pursuit of him and his organization. I guess the question to you, Rob Gavin, and to Brendan as well, is anybody ever going to be able, as Interfor, ever going to be able to collect from Nexium? Because it's still a very open question as to what remains of the corporate structure of Nexium. Immediately after the verdict, you did a story looking kind of at Nexium's operations, the kind of what, you know, the, how much of the superstructure is left. And it was really hard to tell if it still has an operating board, who in fact is kind of paying the bills, who's paying the rent on its many real estate holdings, many of which have are the subject of forfeiture actions by the federal government. So,
yeah, I mean, when I spoke to Rick Ross at the end of that trial, I asked him that question too, like, what's left of this organization? And, you know, we looked at court filings where a lawyer named Michael Sullivan, I believe he was a former U.S. attorney in Boston, was representing NXIVM. He was still officially their attorney. But what's interesting is...
You reached out to him this week and
he has not returned our phone calls. Yeah. What's left of NXIVM is a good question because the judge's decision, this was a New Jersey federal judge who handed down this decision on Monday, she says that she doesn't believe NXIVM exists anymore. Now, whether or not that's actually true, we don't know. And what Rick Ross had said to me when I spoke to him Monday was, you know, who pays for this? Does Claire... The Bronfman,
heir to the Seagram's fortune.
I think it's very telling what's not in the government's forfeiture records, which is any indication that NXIVM has monetary assets, that they have bank accounts. I think if they did, the federal government would have identified them and moved for forfeiture of some of those assets to repay some of these victims. Instead, you see them going after various properties associated with Claire, NXIVM, and some of their associates. And nobody that I've asked that put that question to seems to know. Does NXIVM have assets in bank? Do they have bank accounts? They may not. They may have liquidated them. It's surprising too that the government hasn't addressed that issue. Even if to tell the court, you know, hey, Your Honor, there are no assets here that we can go after. So it'd be interesting to know too if they did pay. Yeah. You know, for instance, AT&T. That was an action against Keith. You know, mm-hmm. claimed he had patents and the judge essentially called him a liar and ruled against him in that case.
And what we know, and it was included in Rob's story back in June, that there is just a dazzling array of kind of corporate structures.
Correct.
That sort of exist under the umbrella of NXIVM. I think there was a list that was entered in one of the court cases that I think it's more than like two dozen.
It's a whole bunch of different names.
Educational projects and publishing, you know, entities and what have you.
What we know is that, what we know from speaking to people is that there are still supporters of NXIVM out there. When I was at the trial, I saw about 7 or 8 people. So we know there's people out there. The question is there a structure there? There's talk that there was a structure in Mexico of some kind. And it's hard to get anybody to come out and say, yes, oh, we're still around. I've reached out to like more than 24 members of NXIVM who just don't get back to me, which is not surprising. But, you know, it makes you wonder what's going on there, and if anything. And there's this interesting part of the criminal case where the sentencings for all these defendants have been indefinitely put off.
Right.
Could there be more charges coming? It does make you wonder if there could be something happening there. And if that were to happen, just totally speculating here, how does that affect the ability of this organization to make whole all the money that they $1.3 million is a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, that seems like a good segue for Brendan to talk about the reversal of fortune in the career of Brandon Porter, the doctor who was involved with NXIVM for many, many years and was in charge of their, well, there's no other way around using the phrase, brain experiments.
Yes, he just lost his medical license in the state of New York. It was revoked. Dr. Porter had been a University of Iowa graduate, got his PhD there as well, an MD from Iowa. He became associated with NXIVM in about 2001 and began overseeing consulting for them on their research programs. In 2009, he moved to Albany and became essentially their official doctor. And the charges against him were that he conducted multiple human research studies with no affiliation as required to any institutional research program. He did research on Tourette syndrome. He did human brain experiments that seemed to have no real research direction to them. And as the health department noted, all the materials from those studies were locked in a Ethical Science Foundation building. And he couldn't even, he had no access to that. So he's supposed to be in charge of that data to secure it, make sure that nothing happens to it. And he didn't even have access to it, they noted.
Ethical Science Foundation being one of the many kind of subsidiary groups.
That's right. And that was, it was funded by Claire Bronfman, And certainly Nancy Salzman, a nurse, a registered nurse, had a big role in a lot of the research that was done. And that research included hooking people up to a brain machine when they were alone in a former restaurant building and showing them very wonderful images, and then showing them gang rapes and beheadings, real beheadings.
Snuff films, things. Essentially.
Yes. And, yeah. And to what purpose, it's unclear. He would... When many people took Nexium's courses, they said it was not unusual, because there was hundreds of subjects, that you would look over and see a student with the EEG brain cap on and Dr. Porter monitoring their reactions to the curriculum. But all of this was unsanctioned medical research. And he identified himself. In one instance, they had a film they produced on their Tourette syndrome work, and he was identified as the researcher. He had brought in many witnesses, some of the names I didn't recognize at all. He brought in another doctor, but the health department essentially punched his ticket and said, you will not practice medicine again in the state of New York.
Yeah. So, yeah. All right, we'll take a quick break and we'll be right back with more Nexium on Trial.
This summer is the 10th anniversary of a period in New York's history that most state lawmakers and political insiders wish they could forget. The plot that unfolded at the Capitol was stranger than fiction and featured a cast of characters destined for jail cells. From the Times Union, it's the Capitol Confidential podcast's Tales from the Coup series. Listen now and subscribe wherever you download podcasts.
So many of those who took guilty pleas before, we've mentioned Claire Bronfman, also the actress Allison Mack, and Kathy Russell, who was a bookkeeper for Nexium, have gone back to the judge in the trial and asked for the lifting of some of their home detention requirements. Yeah. Claire Bronfman's, I think, is the most interesting.
Definitely. Claire Bronfman, who did have a home in Clifton Park, but she got an apartment in Manhattan around the time she was charged. And based on her bail conditions, she's, allowed about 5 hours a week to do shopping, maybe go to the gym over 3 days. She asked the judge to, through her attorney, to relieve that, to let her out of that, have a curfew. And one of the reasons she gave for wanting to be able to leave the house was so that she could get a high school equivalency diploma. She can continue to study for that.
She's 40 years old.
I
think we've previously reported that she never went past the 10th grade.
Right.
Yeah, and it's interesting because here's someone who was on their executive board, someone who's considered a higher up. She clearly was able to go right through the curriculum of Nexium and become this high ranking figure, the director of operations there. And she doesn't have a high school diploma. And it came out during the trial, during the testimony of a former attorney for her father, that there, who of course was that Edgar Bronfman, the Seagram's billionaire, it came out that she had a very sort of naive view of politics and the world and how things came out. And he would explain to her in emails we saw how some of the things she thought just weren't so. And
well, certainly her meteoric rise in Nexium to the director of operations had a little to do
money.
The fact that she had tens of millions of dollars that Keith was burning through.
Such a cynic, Brendan.
That's true. And there's a part cynic that came out where there's testimony in emails where he says to her, she's like, what can I give you to like help out, in return for him helping her? And he says, a lifetime of slavery or a lifetime as my servant, which, as you know, is a subject Keith knows very well. Obviously DOS being the master slave group, which, he had.
So
the case.
The judge told Claire, yes, you can take the high school equivalency test,
yes,
but I'm not going to lift the restrictions on your home detention, which essentially says you've got 5 hours out of the house over the course of a week.
And that posture really made me pause and wonder, is that a signal from the judge that, by the way, you're going to be sentenced to prison as opposed to home detention, which I'm sure they're hoping for a sentence that's somewhere between home detention and supervised release 3 years. It'll be interesting to see, because I think this judge may say to these co-defendants of Keith Raniere, you enabled this.
Correct.
And horrible things were done, and there are real victims here. This is a judge member, we talked about it, who at one point appeared to wipe away a tear listening to the testimony. Mm-hmm. So I think for Claire, that is a bad sign.
And I'll tell you, too.
Know, when you've met all the, you haven't, as far as we know, haven't had any hiccups in your release conditions, mm-hmm. and you ask for a little more, and he says no.
And it's been interesting because there was early on Lauren Salzman, who's the daughter of Nancy Salzman, who was really the biggest turncoat witness. And we had Mark Vicente. Who
Lauren
was,
Salzman.
Lauren
was
Salzman,
the biggest
yeah,
witness, yes.
Who, you know, she's, you know, the daughter of Nancy Salzman, who was NXIVM's president.
And the only co-defendant to testify.
She's the only co-defendant to testify. And she gave devastating testimony against Keith Raniere. Her and Mark Vicente were the two people, part of the government's quote-unquote inner circle of Raniere, who testified. But Lauren Salzman really just sank him with a lot of the details about DOS, a lot of the details about, you know, his cruelty to her. And it brought a lot of sort of just little anecdotes in about Keith Raniere.
Yeah, his cowardice when the Mexican police arrived at the door.
She's there when he gets arrested.
Bounced into a closet.
So she really was able to just, I thought, delivered devastating testimony. And when she asked in early July to go visit, or maybe in late June, to go visit, to have an exception so she could go help her grandparents out, or a grandfather or grandmother out with health reasons, the judge said no. And I was like, wow. And that's someone who he had stood up for and defended from being questioned by Mark Agnifilo during the questioning because he thought he went too harsh and that she was a quote-unquote broken person. And the fact that he wasn't letting her go for that, it was kind of surprising. It showed you, wow, maybe he's going to take a real hard line. He also did not allow her mother to have a relaxed bail status. But then he did allow Kathy Russell, who faces lesser charges. She pled guilty, I should say, to lesser charges. He did allow her to go to Florida for a long weekend to a family funeral.
Right.
And then Allison Mack, this is kind of interesting, Allison Mack, she needed a new ID. Her license was going to expire, so he's allowing her to go get a new license.
To have access to her passport, so she can go get a new,
and I think
get a new driver's license.
It's interesting just to look at this, and I made mention of this in the story the other day. This is an organization where Keith Raniere wanted members of DOS to hold national office and have millions of members around the world, this global reach. And now look at them. They're begging a judge to get a driver's license, a high school equivalency diploma to leave their homes. I mean, it's to say how the mighty have fallen would be putting it real mildly.
I wouldn't be shocked if you see their sentencing memorandums, initially at least, filed under seal. I mean, they may not stay that way. I'm sure we and other organizations would move, but I think they're going to make a pitch, you know, playing every card they can, mm-hmm. from, you know, medical issues to emotional disturbance now or something, to try to alleviate any criminal penalties.
It's really interesting with Allison Mack, too, because we all heard, everything we heard from the defense and from what was expected, is a lot of people expected Allison Mack to testify for the government. Maybe they felt they didn't need her at that point, but maybe she gave information that helped the government out. But it's a real question of what kind of deal is she going to get? You know, how much leniency, if any, will she get? We know what Lauren Salzman did. We know Lauren Salzman delivered the goods when it came to testifying. We know unindicted co-conspirators like Mark Vicente went out there and did that. But with Allison Mack, it's kind of like, well, what would she have said?
She's the only one with a cooperation agreement.
Yeah. You know?
So the others didn't testify, so they won't receive credit. They'll only receive credit for their acceptance of responsibility and pleading guilty. But some of the allocutions arguably fell short of heartfelt apology for all the damage they've done.
The allocutions in open court when they made their
pleas. When they pleaded guilty.
Yeah.
You know, some of them.
Very, very generic.
I thought so. Yeah. I thought, you know, they needed to be a little more. And by the time you get to sentencing, and if you then try to say to the judge, I'm so sorry, you know, there's a good chance the federal judge has already made up his mind.
Yeah.
He's going to listen to you, but he's going to say too little, too late.
I think he has a very little patience for this group. I think he's been through a lot. He's sat through every day of the trial, obviously, and just the sort of look of disgust at times. I mean, there was a lot of, you know, evidence that came out. We're talking about people being burned, people being tortured, people be, you know, people being at the age of 15 having sex with adults. I think he was appalled. So I don't expect him to be particularly lenient based on what I've seen.
If you guys, you've watched a lot of these federal cases, if you were to estimate when you think at least Raniere's sentencing would fall, do you think it would be before or after the first of the new year?
Oh, I'd say after, for sure. I mean, we don't have a date. That's what I said earlier, that when sentencings get adjourned, they'll put a control date on it. They'll say, okay, we're going to move it to January 2nd, and then they keep kicking it. And that, honestly, when his sentencing was originally scheduled for September 25th or something, I did not expect it to be then. I never thought it would be then. But the fact that it's indefinite, it does make you wonder what, you know, maybe there's something else going on there. Could it be because of forfeiture? Could it be that they're, you know, but it does make you wonder, could there be more charges coming down the road? I have heard from people that there could be more charges coming. Their investigation is still ongoing in Brooklyn. And obviously, you know that there could be charges in Albany filed because we had charges kicked up here, which were dismissed in Brooklyn.
And you're specifically referring to
sexual exploitation.
Yeah, sexual exploitation and child pornography.
Correct.
Charges that were basically dropped in the Eastern District case because it was determined that the proper venue for those charges was in the Northern District, which includes the Capitol.
But then they were underlying acts of racketeering. So
we have the makings of a wager here, maybe a beer.
Yeah.
Because I think they'll sentence him before the end of the year, because I think the prosecution, or at least the judge too, will not want some technical flaw in waiting too long to sentence someone to give some grounds for appeal or something along those lines. And as far as the Albany charges, my prediction is that the U.S. Attorney's Office will wait and see what Raniere is sentenced to. And if he gets life, which he could, or a sentence that's equivalent to life at his age of 59 years old, I don't think you'll see him prosecuted in the Northern District, because then they run the risk that a witness who testifies here undermines testimony from the earlier case, opening the door for an appeal of the earlier conviction in some sort. So I think they will say, look, we can't do anything to him that's going to do anything more in terms of punishment. They'll just close that book and walk away.
So,
only if he got a, you know,
the only reason you would do it. I mean, the reason you would do it if you are the Northern District would be, well, there's always, everybody wants to be part of the success. It takes away a little bit of the stigma of, hey, this is your backyard and you didn't do anything about it
for years. Yeah,
but it also shows that in the event unexpectedly that Keith Raniere would have somehow get out of the charges, you win an appeal of the case in Brooklyn, hey, you're dead to rights here on this charge, and we'll hit you on that. That would be it. But Brendan brings up a good point. I mean, you want to make sure, you'd like to think both districts would get together and figure out. But everything I've heard is that about the Eastern District is that if you are expecting that crew to just say, we're done with Keith Raniere and company, my understanding is they're not.
Yeah.
But we'll see what happens, obviously.
So, as we noted, the original sentencing date after the guilty verdict was third week in September. Whether coincidentally or not, the media's interest in NXIVM is, of course, still bubbling, as evidenced this recording of this podcast. But also, there are two books coming out in the third week of September, or at least scheduled to come out. One by Toni Natale, who was a longtime girlfriend of Keith Raniere's, who then got into a very contentious legal ongoing dispute with NXIVM for more than a decade. And that's co-written with Chet Hardin, Metroland reporter in Alt Weekly here in the Capital Region, now unfortunately defunct. He wrote several stories about NXIVM. That book is called The Program, Inside the Mind of Keith Raniere and the Rise and Fall of NXIVM. And also another book from Sarah Edmondson, who was in the Master Slave Organization.
And she ran the Vancouver chapter of NXIVM.
Yeah. And she, in fact, was one of those women who were branded as part of their membership in DOS. Her book is called Scarred, The True Story of How I Escaped NXIVM, the Cult That Bound My Life. In addition to that, there's also a Lifetime TV movie that is going to be coming out next month, starring Peter Facinelli.
From the Twilight series. So yes. The guy who played a vampire in the Twilight series now going to play the Vanguard, Keith Raniere. And it's interesting to look at the trailer they have. They mention a V week, which was the Vanguard week. They have a woman, an actress named Sarah Fletcher, who looks a lot like Allison Mack. They actually made Facinelli resembles Raniere in it. And it'll be interesting to see how these things go. As Brendan knows from the past coverage of the Chris Porco case, sometimes these movies go to Lifetime and you sit there and you say, what is this? Is this anything like the case we know?
I understand Brad Pitt's playing my role.
Yeah.
Can't be that far.
I thought he was playing me, so this is how
we should know the Lifetime movie is based on Katherine Oxenberg's book. That's about right. her attempt to extricate her daughter India from NXIVM. So that's all stuff to look forward to. And well, thanks very much for taking part in this discussion. Rob Gavin and Brendan Lyons, I look forward to stories in the future. And thank you very much for listening. And remember, listeners, you are now holding the marker on the beer bet between Brendan and Rob. I'm Casey Seiler of the Times Union. You've been listening to NXIVM on Trial. We very much like to thank Jeff Anderson and Associates for supporting the Times Union's coverage of the case against Keith Raniere and NXIVM. And once again, as always, I'd like to thank David Lombardo, our podcast whisperer. Thanks very much. I'm sure we will be at this table having a discussion about Keith Raniere and NXIVM in the very near future.